Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Throughout her childhood, Olga Trujillo was subjected to brutal sexual, physical, and emotional abuse at the hands of her father and, after he died, her brothers and their friends. Olga's mother, also suffering from dissociative processes of her own, left her to deal with this brutality alone. Torn apart and desperate to survive, Olga began to create parts to contain certain experiences. This dissociative process was the only way that Olga could manage to wake up each day and function in everyday life. As Olga moved into adulthood, she began to experience an awakening of memories that led to the realization by her conscious self that she had been brutally raped, abused, and neglected by the people she depended on for everything. I want to encourage you to stay tuned for the next hour as my special guest allows us a rare look inside the mind of a young girl suffering from the ravages of complex trauma and shares with us a young woman's battle with the dissociative identity disorder. Olga Trujillo is an attorney, speaker, author, and trauma survivor. Olga graduated from the University of Maryland in 1983. With a bachelor's degree in political science, and from George Washington University's National Law Center in 1988 with a Juris Doctor degree. Her experience over the last 25 years has been as a private attorney, an attorney for the U.S. Department of Justice, a consultant to many local, state, and national organizations on issues of domestic violence, child welfare, sexual assault, trauma, and immigration. Olga is also a nationally sought speaker and author. Her memoir, New Harbinger, for New Harbinger Publications, entitled The Sum of My Parts, was released in October of 2011. Before we begin today's conversation, I want to remind people how they can reach us. You can call locally at 550-8433, or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. And as usual, you have to spell all that out. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E at alaskapublic.org. Please don't hesitate to call in or email us your thoughts or questions. Your calls always do make for a better show. I do want to take a quick moment just to give a heads up that we will be discussing some difficult ideas. So be warned that if you have a history of trauma, some of what we discuss may trigger thoughts or feelings. Or if you have kids that are listening, the content is of a mature nature. So be warned ahead of time. I think we're having some technical difficulties getting Olga on the phone. I wanted to just kind of start off today by talking a little bit about her book while we're trying to get her on there, The Sum of My Parts. It was released in 2011, and it's a survivor's story. It's called The Sum of My Parts, A Survivor's Story of Dissociative Identity Disorder. So the last two shows that I've done have been sort of focused on trauma from the professional standpoint. We talked with Dr. Vander Kolk, Bessel van der Kolk. I guess it was the last show in March, and discussed trauma and PTSD. And then we had Kimber Olson, which was a great show 3 weeks ago, which you can podcast both of those shows. 3 weeks ago, she was on to discuss dissociative identity disorder. Well, dissociative disorders in general, all the way up from just everyday kind of dissociative stuff that happens to us, all the way through DID, dissociative identity disorders, which is what we're hoping to discuss with Olga Trujillo today, if she gets on the phone anytime soon. I know she's in North Carolina and they're trying to reboot the system, so I apologize for our delays. I guess the important thing to remember as we're waiting for this is that dissociative identity disorder is what used to be known as multiple personality disorder, and that the old Sybil idea of people really having separate identities. And I think Kimber talked about that last week. She talked about the different identities and somebody using dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder as a as a defense for a murder trial, which he did not get away with. So, all right, I'm not sure exactly what's happening with the phones here, but I guess... all right, I'm hearing that we don't have a guest for a while, so I'll go ahead and talk about the book a little bit. The Sum of My Parts, as I said, it was written in 2011 by Olga Trujillo, and she was a young woman who grew up fairly poor. Her father was did not speak English. He was a very proud man, and her mother kind of worked out of the house a little bit. And Olga was at home early in her life. Her father began to sexually abuse her and physically abuse her. She watched her mother getting hurt and sexually and physically abused by her father. So her mother also went through her own trauma, which I, as I discussed in the intro, kind of left Olga to deal with this by herself. And the thing that is most remarkable about this book is if you're anybody who's ever experienced anything with any sort of dissociative identity disorder, if you've experienced trauma, reading this book really makes you feel like you're part of something bigger. Like it's not actually, you're not alone in this thing, which seems so isolating. And I mean, can you imagine like a 4 or 5 year old girl in Olga's situation with her father and her knowing that her mother, for some reason, can hear her and is not doing anything to stop it. And then as luck would have it, or I don't know if luck would be the word, but her father passed away at some point in her early childhood. And unfortunately at that point, she kind of thought that it was over, but then her brothers took over, one in particular, but both eventually, and their friends took over the abuse and the trauma that Olga was subjected to. So this book really talks about her survival instinct, and that's what is remarkable about dissociative identity disorder. If you can imagine waking up every day and knowing that the horror of people coming to hurt you and not knowing where it's going to come from, not knowing what night it's going to be, but knowing that it's consistently over time going to continue, and there's nothing you can do about it. The powerlessness. That's one of the things that Dr. Vander Kolk kept going back to, the sense of agency. So it looks like these, we've got it figured out. So hopefully, Olga, have they found you?
Yes, they did.
Oh, thank goodness. Cause yeah, I could just hear myself going on and on and on. I'm sure people were tuning out left and right because I'm not that interesting when I'm not planned, when I don't have it planned. Talk about anxiety. That's a good show for the future.
Yeah, really.
All right. So I don't know. Did you hear my intro, or I guess not? You weren't on the line.
Yeah, no, I wasn't on the line.
Okay, well, I said a whole lot of nice things about you.
Well, that's always good. That's a good way to start.
Yeah. I did. I just talked a little bit about, I think you have actually some of the questions there, so you sort of are aware of how I started, but I talked a little bit about your book in my my monologue that was imposed upon me, and talked about about how your parts began to materialize at one point is kind of where I was. But I do want to say that I loved your book. It was powerful and moving, and I think anybody who's experienced trauma should probably go ahead and get a copy and read it. It was remarkable.
Wow, thank you.
Thank you.
That totally means a lot.
So I think what we'll do here is we'll start, which maybe I should have done this while I was waiting for you, because I have a little piece I wanted to read, but unfortunately my anxiety didn't let me think that clearly. So I do want to, well, let's start with what you're doing professionally, Olga. You're down in, I guess, Wisconsin, and you have Olga Trujillo Consulting. Can you tell us about what that is and what you're doing?
Yeah, I do a lot of speaking and training events nationally and a little bit internationally. And also work with institutions that respond to or provide services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and human trafficking. And I work with them to help them kind of help them understand trauma a little bit better. And I approach it from this inside-out perspective. And my hope is that in working with them that they will incorporate trauma into their, you know, in their responses and their investigations. And that way that, you know, they'll treat victims a little bit better and get better information.
One of the things that Dr. Bessel van der Kolk talked about when he was on was that trauma is the number one America, like the number one health threat in America, and that it's costing us millions and millions of dollars in physical illnesses and psychological illnesses, and that trauma affects the whole organism. So that's is, I mean, why are you doing what you do? Because it sounds like that's what you're fighting.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's, I mean, I think there's lots of reasons that I do what I do, and I'll just say right up front that I work with a lot of people in this field that also have experienced violence, and it's what they do and why they do it.
Right.
And I think for me, what it is it it changes something from being something really bad that happened to me to something I can, you know, something good I can do with it.
Yeah, so you're using it. You're using it to fuel your. I mean, it sounds like it's a passion of yours. You go all over the country. Every time I've talked to you or emailed you, you're in a different part of the country.
Yeah, it is. It's exhausting, but it's, you know, but it's nice to be able to do it. Yeah.
All right. Now you are a trained attorney. That is correct. That's your sort of. You worked for the Justice Department for a while, but your primary calling is as an attorney, at least professionally.
Yeah, I'm an attorney, but I don't practice law anymore.
Okay.
I stopped doing that really once I moved to the Midwest. I kind of, you know, the idea of taking those two bars and then being, you know, and practicing law was just a little more than I wanted to do at the time. So it's fun to be able to do the work that I do, helping with the legal skills that I have and the legal knowledge that I have, and kind of matching that up with what I know about trauma.
Yeah. So you're going out, and you talked about from the inside out, and I like that that terminology. So you're really speaking. And I had these two shows on trauma from, you know, Dr. van der Kolk and then Kimber Olson on dissociative disorders. And I really wanted to follow it up with a more personal story. So that's what I want to get into with you. And I'm really excited you came to share with us. So I appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
Okay. I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs from your book in the early parts. And I'd like to just have you comment on this after I read it. Poppy grabbed me by my shirt and lifted me up. I was filled with terror and couldn't catch my breath. I heard him laugh. I gasped for air. My thoughts raced. He's going to beat me up. He's going to do that thing he does to me. I have to leave. Then I couldn't hear him anymore. I stopped feeling panicked and became numb. I felt my arm split off where my head, where he held my shirt. I went inside my shell and then out onto the ceiling. And from there, I watched as my father hurt someone who looked like me but just wasn't me. He watched my face as he attacked me. I saw in his eyes that he was trying to bring me back, but I stayed on the ceiling, safely away from the pain and rage. Poppy eventually stopped, and I felt like a rag doll, unconscious in the corner of the bed. You talked later in that scene about that your body, just your brain, just couldn't contain all of that information in one part, and that you began to break apart. Can you comment on that? That experience in your life, that was very powerful when I read this.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I used a really powerful coping mechanism in that home. It was just so chaotic and so violent that the only way I was going to survive it was, you know, to pretend it wasn't happening. And what I did is, you know, I split myself off, and I was as creative as I could be. And then a little bit of where, you know, when you talk about like the shell, you know, I spent a lot of time looking at a turtle and imagining what that shell would feel around me. And I think I I, you know, just started creating, like, you know, little parts, and the way I kind of describe it is that I developed this imaginary house in my head, and I put those incidents, those really awful attacks, I separate myself, and then that part of me that experiences that goes into like a closed room, and then once it's over, I don't remember any of it. I don't feel it. I don't remember it. All I have is really anxiety.
Just an underlying sense of anxiety and fear.
Yeah. Well, not even. I mean, I over time, I really start becoming numb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm afraid of my father, but not in the kind of way that you would think with someone being abused so much.
Right. In what way then? I think of just being terrified.
Yeah. Well, see, so I'd be terrified if I knew he was doing all those things to me.
Oh,
because
right.
I'm separating it out, I'm just afraid of him as like someone who's really strict.
You just like, generally like, know. Yeah.
Right. Right. In my mind, like consciously, when I'm not in those rooms where all that abuse is, then it's just he's really strict, and I have to be really good.
Right. I really, when reading this book, I found it to be like really disturbing, and some of the stuff it's quite graphic, and you know, people who have a background of trauma should be careful when they read it. I think if they don't have a place to contain that, but I found it to be disturbing, but also a sense of warmth. Olguita, is that how I pronounce it?
Olguita
is a very, very Olguita, yes, very sweet and endearing girl. You really cheer for her and fall in love with her because I mean she's just like my little girls, right? Which is amazing, and your heart goes out to her. So, what was it like after you read this book and like to read it yourself, or have you read it and realize how many people know things about you that you've had this courage to reveal?
Yeah, you know, when I was writing it, I didn't ever think I was going to read it.
Man.
And I'm not sure why I was thinking that. I think because it is, you know, it's really hard.
Yeah.
But I have read it, and also I've done readings mm-hmm. where I read parts of that first chapter. And you know, the very beginning of that first chapter. That first chapter I think is my favorite chapter because you know, of the role that my next door neighbor plays in my life. But
yes.
But reading it has been really hard for me.
Hmm.
And then reading it out loud, you know, and reading that first part of it has been it's just surprising to me how hard it is. I mean, I lived it, I wrote it, but still reading it is, and then to think. And I think I've gotten used to the fact that people know these things about me. It was at first, you know, I really just didn't think about it when I was writing. But then right before it was about to be released, I got really, really scared.
Right.
I mean, it was like terrifying. Yeah. And but you know, the one thing is that before it was released, I had copies of the book, and gave them to friends of mine,
mm-hmm.
who didn't know about the DID because I hadn't told them, and some of them read it, and some of them couldn't bring themselves to read it, or they read after from chapter 8 on, and I was really scared. I was totally scared that they, I don't know, like, you know, that they weren't going to want to be friends with me anymore. They were going to have a hard time with the fact that, you know, that this all happened to me and that I split myself off and, you know, kind of. And then I was a little bit afraid of the kinds of conversations that I would end up having with people. And, you know, and it turned out to be really great. I had friends that read it, and we had conversations about it that were incredibly vulnerable and incredibly caring, and I feel closer to them than I ever have. And then I have, like, people that I've met since the book came out that have read it and, you know, want to connect with me. And so it's just been, it's been an amazing experience. But yeah, it's really hard to be.
It's, yeah. I asked my wife, I told her, I said, you should read this book. And she's like, yeah, no, I don't think so. Like, because I have three little girls, and she's like, why would I read that book? Like, doesn't make any sense to me. And I, you know, but her, she can't handle that kind of pain to a child, right? And I think that's what it sounds like. It's not, I mean, when I was reading this book, there's no negative thoughts about you, obviously, as a little girl who gets traumatized, but you've internalized so much of that, it almost feels bad, like, right? Nobody else
would. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was totally, I think I reacted a lot like I did when I first was diagnosed. I mean, not as strongly, but when I was first diagnosed, I was scared. I was really, really scared that people would find out and they'd think I was crazy and they wouldn't want me to be their friends, or, you know, that my life was going to fall apart. And I think when the book was about to come out and I was going to come out in a really big way, you know, a little bit of that came back.
Yeah, you didn't mess around. You didn't, like, dabble in it. You go big or go home, right?
Yeah.
So part of the sweetness that I was talking about, part of that gentleness and the endearment, you mentioned it just a second ago, but it really was that relationship with your neighbor. And I wanted to touch a little bit on the three relationships that you write about in the book, for most of the book, that sustained and kind of nurtured you at different and seems like important times. Can you speak about those folks into your life at different moments?
Yeah, so I should first point out that you know, I changed all the names in the book, right?
Right.
So I have to I always have to remember what I called people.
Oh, and, yeah, and I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So my neighbor, I think I refer her as Doña Graciela.
That's her, yes. Doña Graciela, Liz, and your husband David.
Okay. Yeah. So the only names that are the same are mine and my partner's name now.
Okay.
So you know, part of the reason that I wanted to write this book, once I was kind of somewhat convinced to do it, was because of the way that people really changed my life without ever knowing it. And it started with Doña Graciela, and that's that, really, I kind of go into that in that first chapter, and that's part of the reason that that first chapter is my favorite. And so the things that these three people in particular did was they were really critical points in my life. I mean, Doña Graciela is in my life from the time that I'm 3 till I'm 5, very consistently.
When you're most vulnerable, and, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm super vulnerable. And that system in my head of coping is in its development. You know, so when I'm 3 years old and I spend my days with her, my days are full of being told how special I am and being given these little tiny jobs. Like, you know, we're going to go downstairs and do laundry. And my job was to make sure that we didn't fall down the stairs. And to hear this from a 72-year-old woman who everyone in her home, she explains to me that all the women in her home have jobs.
Wow.
And so that if I'm going to be in her home, I have to have a job too. And so my first job is going to be this job that when we go up and down the stairs, I have to make sure we don't fall.
That's an incredibly important job.
I know, right? And so I'm holding. And so what it does is, instead of her, like, telling me, okay, you've got to hold my hand.
Right.
It's up to me to figure out how we do this. And so I hold on to the rail and I hold on to her hand and we go down the stairs. And when we get to the bottom of the stairs, I'm celebrated for having done my job well. So she gives me a big hug and she tells me she loves me and I did great. And so I feel capable and special and smart and creative, and that's what she does all day long. Like, we have, I swear we go up and down those stairs like 10 times a day. And every time, you know, that was my job. And then she, you know, she notices what's happening in our home. I mean, we, you know, we live in a house that's it's a duplex.
And you share a wall. Yeah.
She can hear the stuff that's happening in our home. And she starts talking to me about it. And she lets me know that it's not my fault. She, you know, she teaches me to go hide when I get scared. She gives me a rosary and tells me to take the rosary with me when I get scared. And eventually I'm wearing that rosary all the time, and to keep it, to not just to keep it close to me so that I don't have to go find it when I get scared, but also to feel her close to me. And then the other thing that I realize that I do is when I'm in her home and I feel really good with her, I would start making a fist. It's almost like I'm catching the words that she's saying to me. And I'd make a fist and I hold on to it. And when I'm at home, I'm under my bed and I'm scared, I open my fist and I can hear the words that she says to me, and I can feel the way that I felt in her home. And I think that was the development of, because you know, I develop parts in the back of my house, you know, rooms in the back of my house that are parts of me that took the abuse, and parts of me that were there to make sure that I didn't find out
right,
about the abuse. And then I create parts of me in the front of the house, and those are parts that kind of help me get through the day. And they have roles, you know, they have different roles. And this is my first part in the front of my house. And it's a part of me that's 3 years old, that only speaks Spanish, and that feels good about who I am. And it comes from being in her home.
I wanted to
feel that way whenever I needed to. So I kept that door open, and I had this hallway. And I feel like that really, my time with her really kind of shaped the way that my system inside, my, you know, the parts that I created inside, it shaped the way they formed.
Without her and that part being formed, it might have been a different story, huh?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have had co-consciousness. I'm not sure that I would have been able to move from one part to the other without people noticing.
Because you had that sense of safety, at least.
Yeah. And, I mean, I was never hurt by her.
Right.
And I was constantly, you know, searching her eyes and looking for the look that I would see in my father's eyes right before he hurt me. And I never found it in her eyes.
You never get, she was always safe.
Yeah. She was just really a safe person. Yeah. So that was, she was huge in my life. And what's funny is, you know, I just kind of used everything I could from Doña Graciela. And I took that looking in people's eyes, and applied it to everyone I met after that. And if I saw what I saw in her eyes, which it felt to me like this sense of kindness and warmth, then I'd let myself get close to them. And that's true for Liz and true for David. Like, they were people who immediately I felt safe with.
You could pick that up in their eyes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. And I still do it, you know, to this day.
Right.
I still do it. I'll look in someone's eyes, and if it's there, and it's really hard to explain what it is, but if it's there, I let myself get close to them. And if not, I kind of keep a distance still.
And I bet you're quite attuned and tuned into that sort of stuff. It's survival.
Yeah.
All right, Olga, we're at the halfway point of our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a little break just for about a minute. You're listening, remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our topic today is trauma and recovering from dissociative identity disorder. If you have any questions, well, actually, our phones and emails are still down, so we're not going to get any questions or comments. Oh, no, they're up. I'm sorry. So I'm getting an indication that they are up. So if you have any questions or comments, you can call us at 550-8433 or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with our guest, Olga Trujillo. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is trauma survivor, author, speaker, and attorney Olga Trujillo. Olga is talking to us today as a trauma survivor and as someone who has battled back from dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder. I want to remind listeners, Dr. Woodard continues to host Line One 3 Mondays each month, and I'll do a show once a month, typically the last Monday, on a mental health topic. I guess the Starship is correct. The Starship Line One is correct, and we can take phone calls at our local number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And email your questions for Olga to line1@alaskapublic.org. Remember, the show repeats tonight at 9, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording. We'll not be accepting phone calls. Okay, Olga, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
All right. So we talked a little bit about Donna Graciela. And so then the next person in your life that really had a big impact was Liz, right? And she came in.
Yeah. So Liz was a lifeguard at our pool when I was 12 years old and she was 18. So she was 6 years older than I am, or still probably still is 6 years older than I am. And she became like an older sister to me. And she really kind of saved me when it seemed to me that things were their worst. So what happened at that point is that my father has passed away. My father passed away when I was 11.
Right.
And my brothers are now abusing me, and they're perpetrating rapes and gang rapes against me. And so they're teaching their friends that they can do this to me. And I'm coping in the same way that I did as a kid, and which means that, you know, like that I'll be attacked and I'll escape and go someplace in my head, and you know, part of me will kind of take that attack and then go away, and so then I won't remember that happened to me. So I don't tell anybody. And I don't fight back. And after a bit, I learned to accommodate the abuse. Mm-hmm. So it's a really, really chaotic and really awful time. And so I go, there's this one place really in my neighborhood that's safe. And it's because she's there and that's our pool. And she, you know, I think because another 12-year-old was trying to teach me how to swim, because I didn't know how to swim.
Right.
She took an interest, because so she had offered to teach me how to swim, and I'd come in early, and she'd give me swimming lessons, and then I would just hang out with her at the pool, and then eventually she started ask me if I wanted, you know, she'd take me out to dinner or take me to the movies. And really, she just became an older sister to me, and it was amazing. You know, I'd hang out with her, and we'd watch tennis, and she taught me how to run, and I was playing at the time. I started playing basketball when I was in second grade, and then later I started playing softball and ran track. So, and she was, you know, very much into sports, and so she was helping me with all that, like with my skills in basketball and getting my, you know, getting in shape. And so I was really lucky, and she was in my life really from the time that I was 12 until the time that I was 26.
Wow, that's 14 years. I mean, my math is not super great, but I can do that. Do you think she sensed something in you or picked up something in you that you were in need of that? Or, I mean, why just take this little kid under your wing for 14 years?
Yeah. You know, I think it was that she could tell that I needed, something, you know, some kind of guidance. And I think if she didn't know, she suspected that, that something was going on. There's a time that I remember that she picks me up and she notices bruising.
Mm-hmm.
And she tries to get me to see it. And I cannot, like, I remember that so well, like looking at the bruises that I have and not feeling like they were on my body.
Like that's not yours.
So, right. Yeah. Those aren't my legs. That's not, those aren't my bruises. Yeah. And I just couldn't figure out, like, I couldn't go there in my head. I just couldn't know what was going on. It wasn't safe. I still had to go back into that home.
Did she ever find out?
No, I haven't been able to find her.
I was just wondering.
Because I was 31 before I started the process of healing.
Wow. All right. Yeah. Well, that's really, that's the next question that I want to get into is the healing part. But you haven't been able to find her. I wonder, like, she must have read this book. She must, or I don't know. It would be really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
Really interesting, because she was an important person in your life.
Yeah.
I have an email I want to read to you. It says, Olga, we live in Wisconsin and have DID. We were diagnosed about 4 years ago at age 48. We read your book, which made us feel like we're not alone in this. The abuse started at age 3 and continued for many, many years. It's been extremely difficult finding a therapist who will help us. Everyone we call says they won't take us on. It's difficult getting people to understand us and not be afraid. How do you explain or help people understanding DID?
Wow. Yeah. So the way I explain it is I let them know that, you know, this is the coping mechanism that I developed because of really awful stuff that happened to me. And that it means that, you know, and this sounds really self-serving, but it means that I'm smarter than the average person. Like, I have to have a certain level of intelligence to be able to do that. And most therapists that I've talked to around the country, actually really, it's really hard work working with people who have DID. It's also incredibly rewarding.
Right.
Because we can heal, because there is, you know, the work is really hard, but it really, we move through it. So they see kind of progress, and they see people who are, you know, pretty smart people living, you know, pretty high functioning lives. So one of the things I would suggest is looking at the, there's a good website. I think you guys talked about it when Kimber Olson was on the ISSTD website, which is the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation.
Yeah, that was up on our website. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would look there. They have a list of clinicians that that work on trauma and dissociation, and she might be able to find somebody in that area that that knows DID and is willing to work with people with it.
Yeah, it seems like she should probably really focus in on that specific, like, looking for people with DID experience in dissociative disorders and trauma, because there's got to be people that work with that, I would imagine, in Wisconsin. We have them in Anchorage.
Yeah. I think it depends on where in Wisconsin.
Right, yeah, maybe not.
But I think, like, I know where I live, it'd be a little harder, but then I would go, I live closer to Minnesota, and I would just go into St. Paul or Minneapolis. But in Madison or Milwaukee.
So I want to read what you wrote when you talked about your diagnosis, which goes into what this emailer is talking about. You said, "I was shocked and terrified to hear that Dr. Summer say I had what was formerly known as multiple personality disorder. Is that like Sybil? Am I like the woman in the Three Faces of Eve? My head began to spin. What do I have inside me? Is there a crazy person in there? What am I? I felt like a freak. I was afraid to have anyone know. I have a mental illness. People make fun of people like me. Upon hearing my diagnosis, I stopped thinking of myself as smart, creative, or clever, even though Dr. Summer had worked hard to help me understand that I had developed an amazingly adaptive survival technique. I no longer thought of it that way at all." So that diagnosis was pretty devastating for you, huh?
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was awful. Yeah, the thought of it. I mean, you know, I was worried that I was going to lose all my friends. I was married. I was afraid I was going to lose, you know, my husband. And I was afraid I was going to lose my job. And
you were at the Justice Department at that point, right?
Yeah.
That's big time.
I was a general counsel in the part of the Department of Justice that gave away all the grant money.
Hmm.
So, that was a big job for me to have at such a young age.
Right.
And to get that job, you know, and to keep that job, I had to have a security clearance. And the kinds of things that they ask you to get a security clearance are they're looking at ways in which people might compromise you.
Right.
You know, can they blackmail you? And, you know, at that time they were asking about sexual orientation. If they were asking about sexual orientation, what if they find out about this?
Right. Yeah, this is big.
Yes. This is really big. And I was just terrified. Yeah, and it turned out okay, but
the stigma.
I was so afraid.
It's like the sensational ones, like DID, the personality disorders. You know, all you got to do is say borderline. It used to be multiple personality, schizophrenia, substance abuse. I mean, if you're a drug addict, that's a bad one too. But all these things have the stigma attached to them, and it sounds like that's what you were feeling.
Yeah, you know, I meet people all the time. There's a great conference once a year in Orlando that's called the Healing Together Conference, where people who have DID come to it with their supports, and clinicians come who are working with people with DID, and it's really kind of a one of its kind conference. And I meet people there and who have DID, who are, you know, judges, doctors, lawyers,
right,
academics. I mean, all over the place, and it's the exact same thing. It's the fear that people are going to find out, and not just our jobs, but our family members are going to find out. You know, our spouses and
you talked about people
friends.
Worrying that people wouldn't want you to play with their kids.
Yeah,
that's intense.
That was like one of my biggest fears was like, oh my God, people aren't going to let me meet their kids and they're going to be afraid of me.
Yeah, but like you were dangerous, which you've never been, right? I mean,
right, never. Yeah.
That was not how it turned. It turned out for you. You didn't go that way. You went the other way. You went to healing.
Right.
Yeah. So in your recovery, in your talking with Dr. Summer, I want to read one more thing and ask you a question about your mother, because that's something that keeps like getting into my head, like this whole experience of your mother being there and knowing what was going on. But just this one, page 199, I was getting stronger, but the memories were getting worse, like one of those computer games that gets progressively harder to match your increasing skill. My agile mind was still protecting me by keeping memories away until I was strong enough to deal with them. During a session towards the end of the six-month deal I had made with Dr. Summer, a part of me came forward that held only a pair of eyes. I didn't know whose they were or what their significance was. And then another part came forward with more information about the eyes. The eyes were watching Mike and his friend Harold rape me in the bathroom. It still didn't make any sense because I already knew that Mike and Harold had raped me. Then another part offered the face that belonged to the eyes. It was my mom's face. So I read that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah. So that was a pretty intense moment. And that's in the recovery. All this stuff is starting to come back to your, is it called consciousness or awareness?
Yeah. It's all coming back into my consciousness. Yeah.
And then how do you... Go ahead.
Yeah, that was devastating. Like, to that realization that my mom had seen my brother's and my brother's friends rape me and not do anything about it was really hard for me. And I was furious. And I mean, I had a lot of rage. I had a lot of rage toward my father, you know, and my brothers. And my connection to my mom, you know, I felt so close to her and so protective of her. And so
right.
This was such a blow to me. And what I had to do, you know, I had to understand how that happens in a home. So at this point, I think I'm like 15 or 16 at this point. And so my mom would have been through 15 years of abuse with my father, plus, you know, mm-hmm. another 3-4 years since my father died. And then on top of that, I think my mom, like the things that I saw in my mom were things that that make me think that she coped in a way that was similar to mine.
Right. Just checked out.
And yeah, she just went somewhere in her head. And that's what I remember of my mom, is just kind of getting this, you know, like, you know, that first time that my father hurts me in front of my mom, that he rapes me in front of my mom goes, she dissociates.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and I know what that is now. And in the process of healing, it's what I remember, that my mom copes and she knows how to cope based on her history. Just like at 15 and 16, I'm going to cope the way I did when I was 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
She just never got help.
Yeah, she never got help.
All right, if you're just tuning in, my guest today is childhood trauma survivor Olga Trujillo. As always, you can reach us with your questions or comments at 550-8433. You can probably, if you call now or send an email now, I can probably get it on the air in the last, say, 10 minutes or so. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so Olga, I wanted to get really quick. I have a client who recently asked me a question. She said, why should we do this? Because she's got some stuff like in the background that's similar. I mean, it's stuff you don't want to read about. But she said, why do this, digging around in my past? She said, I have it all secured away in little boxes, and why should I open them up? Just because you tell me to? That why should she do it? She says, I don't want to look at this stuff.
Yeah. So you know, really good question. And I remember asking that question quite a bit too. And so, you know, what I would say is my experience after digging around in my past, what I found is that it released me from so much of the pain.
Hmm.
And the hold, that hold, it released me from that hold that my past had on me. And after kind of, you know, like for me, meeting all those parts and figuring out what their role was in my survival and in my everyday helped me to get cooperation, to really to integrate. And But even if I hadn't been able to integrate, I would have been able to go through my life a lot easier. But for me, like having done all that work, where I am is I have a sense of peace and calm in my life that I wouldn't have without it. And I have confidence in who I am and what I can do. And I have that from inside myself. So I'll say that I'm a much happier person than I would have been had I not looked at that stuff.
Had you just kept running?
Yeah, if I just kept running.
What was the thing that made you begin the journey to heal?
You know, it was the actual trigger itself was the movie Thelma and Louise.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I know, isn't it funny?
Oh, that's random, yeah.
The beginning of that movie.
Huh.
And because the very beginning of that movie has a pretty vivid attempted rape scene. And that was a trigger for me. But I think what made it possible was, you know, I was at the time I was married, and I had a great relationship, you know, a great husband,
Right. Really
supportive, caring person. And then I had a
That's the third person we didn't get to.
Right, David.
Yeah.
who was really kind of a model for how you support someone who's going through something like this is the things that he did for me.
He was so patient and gentle and thoughtful. Yeah.
I know. Yeah, he totally was. It's like when I think of how you love someone well,
right.
I think of how he loved me.
That's nice.
Yeah. So I was in this relationship where I had safety and I was financially secure and I was professionally secure
and
had done well. So that's the safest place I had ever been in my life.
And you were how old when you started doing it?
I was 31.
Okay, young. Pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like that now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But yeah, so at 31, I went to go see that movie, and I had what I thought was a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
But what it really ended up being is, I guess, you know, it's what they call, I think, an ab reaction. So that scene in that movie was a trigger, so like an emotional reminder of something that had happened to me. And so for me, like in my head, that all came together as if it were happening to me right then and there. And so what I felt was the panic of the realization that I was going to be raped, and then the physical pain from the rape. And it was, you know, the first memory of rape that I had when I was 3. But I didn't know that at the time.
Right.
All I knew was that I was panicking.
Stuff was just starting to bubble up. I mean, that's kind of
how it was as if really kind of what happened was is it wouldn't stop. Like, it was stopping me in my tracks. Like, I couldn't do anything. So I had to deal with what was causing my panic.
Yeah, and I have my same client talks about how she feels it in her stomach. She gets sick, and she doesn't know why. She doesn't know what it is, but when we start talking about her childhood, 5 to 10, she gets really, really sick, and she's not sure why, but sounds like something's down there that she knows she doesn't want to look at it.
Yeah.
I got a quick email, and it's a question a lot of people ask because I know Kimber touched on it last week or last time. How do you sort out real versus false memories? You're talking about recovering these memories. So, how's that? How do you know these are real versus stuff that maybe you saw or planted or read about or I don't know, something?
Yeah. You know, well, so that's actually a really good question. And I went through that and that there's a real clear difference for me. So, when I start remembering something that really happened to me, I was getting the thought first, and then once I shared the thought, I'd get more and more thoughts and more kind of like pictures of it, and then the feelings would come, the emotional reaction would come next, and then the physical pain of it would come.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example. When I was going through a lot of the healing work that I was doing, it was around the time when all the priest abuse stuff was being revealed and written about.
Right, yeah.
So I kept hearing about this, you know, and I grew up Catholic. So I had this, like, weird thought one day that maybe I was abused by, you know, a priest at our church.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said to my psychiatrist at the time, I wonder if I was abused by a priest at my church. And that's it. That's all that came to me. No feelings, no thoughts, nothing else.
Huh.
And And that's so that's not something that happened to me. That's just a thought that's kind of running around in my head because of everything that's in the news. So that's dramatically different than something that really happened to me. So if I wondered about something because it was in the news, it wouldn't stay with me. I wouldn't start seeing it. I wouldn't start feeling it. It wasn't my experience. So it was just something that I wondered about.
Dr. Vanderkolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, I don't know if you've looked at it yet, but it's a really good book on trauma. And that's what he's talking about. And that's what you're talking about, that physiological response to a memory.
Right.
That the body remembers it even when your conscious mind does not.
Right, exactly.
And that sounds like what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll have all the... So if it didn't happen to me, I won't have all that. I won't have all the ways in which my body remembers it.
Yeah. So we got just a couple minutes left. I want you to talk just briefly about complex trauma is a long-term project, right? Getting better from it. And real quickly, how do you know if you got the right therapist or how you do know if you're making any progress?
Yeah. So, you know if you have the right therapist is if you can kind of, the way I looked at it is I had enough structure in my session that I could fall apart in my sessions.
Right.
Like there was enough, like I trusted him enough. I felt confident in his skills enough that I could just focus on the work and really go to it. And I worked with someone before I worked with my psychiatrist, and since then I've tried to find people, you know, in my area just for kind of support and stuff. And I hadn't, like, the person I worked with before I was referred to the psychiatrist that I worked with, and his name in the book is Dr. Summer.
Right.
I worked with someone who, you know, could tell I had DID and was new at working with it.
Uh-huh.
And I was uncomfortable in her sessions, and I was having many like panics in her session because she was noticing changes in me and talking to me as if I was somebody different, but didn't get me to learn about the diagnosis of DID and have any kind of acceptance.
Was it more of a comfort thing for you? I mean, you were comfortable.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, Olga, gotta go. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. I wish we had more time.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thanks again to Olga Trujillo for allowing us to witness her story today. It was a real honor to be allowed inside your mind, Olga, and to hear your deliverance from suffering. Please remember to check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to line one. If you'd like to continue today's conversation, please join KSK on Facebook, and you can find the link on our website. That's alaskapublic.org. Next week, Dr. Woodard hosts Drs. Brian McMahon and Dr. Jay Butler on a discussion of hepatitis A, B, and C. The conversation will focus on risk factors, immunization, and prevention, the natural history of these very different infections, and new developments in treatment. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. And remind listeners that you can podcast today's show at alaskapublic.org. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. I hope you enjoy the show. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.